Welcome to Pop the Left with C. Derek Varn and Douglas Lane. This episode covers the Communist Manifesto.
One of the things that's going to come up as we talk about the manifesto, I guess, is how much this we think holds even 30 years later.
Well, I mean, was this again another moment where they were calling for this as a way to escape these kingdoms that would, as you know, constantly taking territory and the competition between royal families that were intermarried and also international?
Yeah, I think it was. And I think the other thing for Marx and Engels, although Marx, again, is a little cagey on this when you read his later writings, but Marx seems to have thought, at least in the context of Europe, that a bourgeois revolution was necessary for a communist one to happen. Now, I say that in the context of Europe. He does not seem as clear-cut on that outside of Europe. So the infamous letters to Vera Zurlich, when he talks about the alternate path possible for Russia and implies that there might be different paths for Asia and Americas too, is one of those issues. But yeah, I mean, if you look at – I mean, before we get into the manifesto, we can just look at the demands of the German Communist Party because it comes up twice. And the committee for that is Marx, Engels, and Wolff, who are the people from the Communist Correspondence Project, and Snapper and Bauer – who are the non-Witterlingites, the League of the Just. So this is what they come up with. And like, we can talk about this for the second in the context of the time, because some of this is going to seem pretty like really low stakes, even compared to what Marx and Engels say later in their critiques of, you know, early social democratic programs. So right. The immediate demand, the whole of Germany shall be declared a single indivisible republic. Representatives of the people shall be paid so that workers can also sit in the parliament of the German people.
Mm-hmm.
The universal arming of all peoples. The estates of princes and other feudal estates on mines pits shall be transformed into state property. On these estates, agriculture is to be conducted on a very large scale and with the most modern scientific means for the benefit of all society. Mortgages on peasant holdings shall be declared state property. Interest on such mortgages shall be paid by peasants to the state. So interesting, they're not calling for the abolition of peasant property yet.
No, that's later.
Yeah. In the districts where tenant farming is developed, land rent or farming dues shall be paid to the state as a tax. All means of transport, railways, canals, steamship roads, posts shall be taken over by the state in order to be converted into state property and put to the disposal of non-possessing class free of charge.
Yep.
Limitation of the right of inheritance, introduction of a steeply graded possession of taxation, and the abolition of tax on consumer goods. Ha ha ha. I mean, anyway, that's funny. The establishment of national workshops, the state shall guarantee a living wage to all workers and provide for those unable to work, universal free elementary education.
Right.
So we have
nothing about health care.
Yep. You'll notice we have, and we also have half of that already.
We do.
And in some, I mean, Marx would later critique the LaSallians for making some of these demands because, like, they already have that in America, like in 1870. So I mean, it's interesting the context of this, right? Because I mean, except for the focus on state property, which again, like Engels and interestingly, Engels and Marx would become more skeptical about later. This reads like, you know, this is like just two steps more radical than Bernie Sanders.
Sometimes it's more radical than Bernie Sanders. Sometimes it's not. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, it's all over. I mean, like from our perspective, it's all over the place.
Right. But from their perspective, these were clearly radical democratic demands.
Right. Now, what's interesting is to put that in the context of the manifesto, which it is also part of. But the manifesto is like its framework is way more radical. That's what's interesting about the manifesto is the actual demands are kind of milquetoast. But the framework is a very particular framework that comes out of Marx and Engels that really changes the way socialists talk about.
Can we go through the demands that are actually in the manifesto? At least the ones So I'll read those. The first one is the abolition of property and land and application of all rents of land to public purposes. The second one is a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. So I guess that means that the state is becoming the employer, at least when it comes to agriculture. Right. The state owns all the land. Abolition of all rights of inheritance. The confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels. So that's an interesting one. Centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. The centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. That's, we heard that one before, at least on the transport. The extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state. The bringing into cultivation of wastelands and the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan. Equal liability of all work. Establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. The combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries. And the gradual abolition of all the distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of the populace over the country. So relocation of people.
It's even kind of more radical than that if you actually think about it, because it's also a change in the way we produce. It would mean it would mean also that industrialization would not be centered in cities.
But it would – I mean, yeah, but – implementation is key here. Are you going to move people and have them start these new enterprises, or are the enterprises going to start to be built first?
It's huge. But like what I love about the manifesto is, in some ways, it's like way more radical than anything you'd see in the Goethe and Erfurt programs. In right. other ways, it's really, really not. So
right. Free education for all children in public schools, abolition of children's factory labor in its present form, but here's the key, combination of education with industrial production. So they get they give kids schools, they get rid of children's factory work, but they keep them working as right. a part of their education, which I'm not sure I'm against, but really that, again, implementation is everything. but yeah, so there's those are the 10 demands that I pulled out of the Communist Manifesto.
So one of the things that's interesting about this is, one, you notice that you move from the manifesto to the demands of the from the demands of the Communist Party to the demands of the manifesto. The manifesto is more international. It is not as concerned with the immediate goings on in Germany. It also sees some things that we pointed out in 1848 that we really see for the first time, which is the division in political attitudes between the countryside and the city because of a difference of relationship of production. So like Marx is onto something there, because that division is a problem for socialists. It has plagued us forever.
Yeah.
Because the structural incentives for agricultural labor are radically different than for urban services and industrial production.
Right. Yeah. And at the time they could see that, and it's still the case today, even though
it's less of the case of today, but it's still the case.
Yeah. Just briefly, at the time, what were the major, was it a matter of still wanting to hold on to a kind of guild approach to production in the rural areas, or was that more likely to happen in the cities?
That happened in both. The major issue seems to be how tied up the peasants and the rural
workers
were still, for psychological reasons, kind of tied to the land.
Property. It was a matter of their wanting to own and control their own
property.
Land. Property.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, though. In England, that wasn't a problem. And this is actually one of the weird things that makes England different from the other bourgeois societies. Mm-hmm. There was never land reform, for all farming was tenant farming, unless you were nobility. All farming was tenant farming. So the attachment to the land there was different than in the United States and in Germany and in France. And in Germany and France, this is a big deal, because that tension is what the reactionaries use to get people into the armies from the countryside to suppress the rebellions in the cities where they have popular support.
Right.
And like Marx calling that in 1840, I mean, Marx and Engels and the Communist League calling that in 1847, before it happens in 1848, is really prescient.
Right.
Because they're seeing it right before it actually becomes a major issue, in a very real way.
Right.
To hear the complete discussion, please subscribe to our Patreon feed.